Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, November 5th. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Copyright Forum today. And joining us to answer your questions about protecting your writing, music, and art are Paul Rapp and Polly Law. If you have a question about copyright law, fair use, what's in the public domain, etc., give us a call, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is the number. You may also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Paul and Polly. It's almost like that singing group, Paul and Paula. Your copyright call is coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Copyright Forum today, and we welcome Paul Rapp, an intellectual property lawyer and writer. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, and businesses involved in the creative economy. He's a frequent lecturer on intellectual property issues. Also with us is Polly Law, a past president of the Graphic Artists Guild, an organization focused on the rights of artists. She is a designer, illustrator, an artist. Her works are in all kinds of fancy places. We'll talk about that in a minute. Give us a call at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org if you have an intellectual property question, 800-348-2551. Paul and Polly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how you doing? We'd be remiss to say that our third wheel, Mr. Westwood, William Westwood, is homesick. He's got a laryngitis and a cold. We both have colds.
Oh, also, thanks for sharing. So, that's great.
Well, we'll try not to.
That's okay.
But you know, hopefully Bill won't call in with a difficult question. We'll be able to
test you guys.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, Bill, we'll give you a shout out. I hope you're feeling better. Polly Law, how's that art thing working out for you?
Well, it's going. Last weekend, two weekends ago, I guess, the 25th and the 26th of October, I was part of a inaugural print fair that we held at the Troy Atrium just across the river. And it was sponsored by the Printmakers Guild of New York, which I am a member, and I was on the organizing committee. And it was very well attended and very well received. And
that's good.
Yeah.
Cool.
What form of arts do you do? Now, printing is one that I
silkscreen.
Yeah, that's
especially.
What I thought you did a lot of that.
That's my print medium. And then I also do what's called papier collé, which is, it's a collage form where instead of using, as in traditional collage, you use like bits of newspapers or magazines or whatever, pre-printed materials.
And, okay, this is great now. Talk to me about the copyright issues there.
It's a real swamp. Usually it's considered to be fair use because it's very transformative.
Okay, so you're using one piece of a cutout of something in part of a larger thing.
But not only that, but you're using it as, say, a bit of texture in a bird's wing or something.
I see.
You're not using it necessarily as itself. So, collage is a sticky wicket if you're using pre-printed material.
Yeah.
I make my own material. I make what are called paste paint papers.
Yeah.
And so I make my cut paper work out of that.
So you're okay.
I'm clear.
You know, and we've talked about this before, and I never quite figured it out. So Warhol did these paintings, right? But weren't they based upon photographs?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
mostly did screen prints, actually. They weren't paintings, per se. They were screen prints based on photographs.
And how do you get away with that?
I think people, you know, I'm sure he got sued a couple of times, but I think most people just thought
he got sued by the Campbell's Soup folks.
Yeah, but then they realized this is the best thing that ever happened to him and backed off. And I think a lot of photographers are doing the same way. I mean, Andy's doing a screen print based on your photograph. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, you
If he's in a gallery, or not Andy Warhol, he's not going to do much of anything right now. But if I went in and took a picture, a photograph of something that's hanging, I'm allowed to use it in any way I want?
No.
So how is it different for Andy Warhol?
Because he's Andy Warhol.
Yeah, and also he was taking an image, and there's something to be said. He chose his images because they were iconic.
Yeah.
They weren't just everyday images. He chose Chairman Mao. He chose Marilyn Monroe. He chose Campbell's tomato soup. And he used them as a basis for his silkscreen. Now, I mean, if I, you know, looking at them myself, I'd say, well, that's not exactly transformative.
I agree.
What he's done.
And yeah, I think with the Supreme Court's ruling last year involving Andy Warhol and the Andy Warhol Foundation, they've greatly restricted the whole notion of transformative. So, you know, because of Andy's suit that was decided last year, if that had been the law, you know, 60 years ago when he was doing his stuff, he might have had a hard time getting away with it. People may have come after him.
The number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a copyright question for Paul Rapp and Polly Law. 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Paul, what's fair use?
Fair use is when you are allowed to use a piece of copywritten material and it's deemed not infringing. Research is important. Education. Commentary. I mean, if you're going to make a commentary on a movie, you should be able to show some film clips from the movie while you're making your commentary. You know, it's determined that, you know, overlooking the person's copyright is more important than the person's copyright, you know, for First Amendment purposes and for just the greater good. And so it comes up all the time in filmmaking. I'm dealing with a couple of films right now where I'm grappling with, you know, whether the third-party clips are going to be allowable or whether they're going to have to go get a license. But, yeah, it's been part of the law since the mid-1800s, and it's been part of the statutory law since the 1970s.
So when the law was written then in the mid-1800s, it was specifically about written material.
That it was then, yeah. I mean, I think the first
visual images weren't covered by copyright back then.
Yeah, and you're right. And the first case I think was a presidential biography where they printed excerpts of some letters that the president had written or that had been written to him, and you know, some of the people that wrote the letters, you know, were complaining, and the judge said, no. It's better for the world to see this stuff than for you to protect your copyright in personal letters that, you know, are of historical import.
Okay, and that's the key, because if somebody printed letters from Joe Schmo, who was not president, that's a different ball of wax, right?
If it was meaningless, you know, if you were printing it to show how stupid Joe Schmo was, perhaps because of his political affiliation or otherwise, I think you know what we're talking about. But you know, then you're making a comment on the original work on Joe Schmo's letter. Just by printing it, you're making a comment about, you know,
you're showing it for the world to see how stupid Joe Schmo is.
And so, yeah, but it's beguiling. It's case by case, so there's no bright line. I mean, it's like why God invented attorneys is to figure this stuff out.
So this is your
out.
Cash cow then. But it doesn't come ultimately down to the whims of the judge.
It does, you know. And in most cases, and I probably would agree, you look at it and you go, that's fair use. Or you look at it and you go, that's not fair use. And then you have to spend 40 pages describing how you came up to that gut reaction.
And there's, what, seven categories that define fair use?
Four, but they're non-exclusive. All kinds of other stuff could come in. You know?
Well, like back in the day, I think this was like maybe 30 years ago, the Postal Service was was claiming that people could not, what was it? Oh, that people who did stamp art had to cede their rights to, I'm thinking of Work Made for Hire.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Never
that's
mind.
That's later in the show.
Yeah. Never mind.
The number here is 800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. It's the Copyright Forum today with Paul Rapp and Polly Law. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll hit the phones. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Zach, the engineer, is laughing about something in there. Did I? You didn't open the mic just now, did you? Oh, good, good. Because that would have been... there you go. I was just telling the history of this song here in the studio to our guests, Paul Rapp and Polly Law. That was Baby Elephant Walk by Henry Mancini. And I'll tell you, I told this in a live event, so I'll tell you right now. You know, I picked the music for this show weeks in advance, and I don't look at the scripts. So bottom line is I had a bariatric medicine show on Medical Monday, and this was one of the bumpers. And boy, were people upset about that. I said, you know, it was a mistake. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum with Polly Law and Paul Rapp, and let's go to Woodstock. Harriet, you're on.
Hey, Polly, it's Hattie.
Hey, Hattie, how are you?
Pretty good, thanks. It's great to hear you. So my question is, if an artist illustrates a book, who has the copyright?
Do you have...
What separates the artwork from the writing in terms of the whole product?
Do you have a contract that you... drew up before you started working on this?
No.
Yeah, I mean, generally the artist is going to retain the copyright, but even if you don't have an agreement, there's an implied license that they can use it in the book. But you know, sometimes I think with children's books, often they retain the copy. The publisher will retain the copyright to everything. And I think that's particular to the children's book industry, but for other, for, you know, magazines and books with illustrations and photographs and whatnot, you know, there's an implied license because you gave it to them to be in a book or a magazine for them to use it for that, but they're not going to be able to use it for much else because you retain all the rest of the rights.
Let me go back for a second.
Say it again, Harriet.
When you said the publisher owns the copyright, that's to the whole thing.
The publisher registers the copyright to the whole shoot and match.
But they often do it in the names of the author and the illustrator. Retain a license to print it in the context of the book. You know, forever.
Yeah, they can't go off and use it for another project.
Right.
Like you can't take the illustrations and turn them into Christmas cards or something.
No. Unless there's a license that says something to the contrary,
And if you haven't signed an agreement, the rights, all of those rights, you retain unless you sign them away.
Right.
So if you get an agreement from them after the fact, have a lawyer look at it.
All right. I don't think it's going there. But just, it was a curious thing. I thought, like, for instance, when Arthur Rackham illustrated Wind in the Willows.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's way in the past, and the copyrights have all run out. But so many times his illustrations were put out without the context of the story. So I was just interested in the difference between the writing and the artwork.
Is this a project where you were hired by the writer, or did you work with the writer beforehand? Is this a joint project, or was this something where you were hired by the publisher to illustrate?
No, it's kind of complicated and non-specific. So it would be too convoluted to
Okay.
Take up the whole show.
It's a super long history.
We have time.
Well, Harriet, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum today. Polly Law is here. Paul Rapp is here. We were talking about fair use earlier. Since we have had this boom in electronic arts, music and visual and everything else, have fair use lawsuits gone up and up and up?
I think they have recently because of the Warhol decision, which cut back a lot on what fair use was.
What about satire?
Satire is... and they made clear on this, it used to be okay, but they've said it's, satire is fine, but using it to, to put lyrics in a song to talk about something other than the song or the band is not.
You'll have to give me an example. I'm not following
using
that.
A melody that already exists and then putting new words to it that have nothing to do with the original song.
Yeah.
So in other words, Weird Al's in trouble.
He always gets permission, yeah. Even though he never needed to back in the day, but he still does it. I mean, he wanted to do an album of Prince songs as polkas, and his uncle was one of the greatest polka accordionists.
Frank, what's
his last name?
Yankovic.
And Prince said no, because he's Prince. And so he scrapped the decision, even though legally he probably could have gone ahead.
But you don't want to tangle with someone with a lot more money than you,
no,
right?
No.
And isn't that a problem? I mean, a lot of these corporations can sue you to death, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah, and fair use is a defense to a claim of infringement. And so, you could have a clear fair use argument, and it would cost you tens of thousands of dollars to get to it in a court of law if someone was, really being a jerk and coming after you.
I think that's a problem, right?
It's a big problem, but it's kind of endemic in the American legal system. The people with the most money, have the biggest chance of winning.
Frankly,
every time.
The lawyer doesn't look that upset about it, Polly. I'm not sure.
I've never been on that side.
Okay. Oh,
I've always been on the other side.
It's resignation. It's not support.
Yeah. The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question about your art, your writing, your businesses in the creative economy, 800-348-2551 is our number. WAMC is our website. voxpop@wamc.org is our email address. By the way, in the introduction for Paul Rapp, you represent musicians, writers, fine artists, and businesses. Polly, you're a visual artist.
Yes.
That's a fine art. What is not a fine art?
I am not a fine artist, according to the... I am when I display things in galleries. So, yeah, now I am. But for most of my career, I was a commercial artist. I was an illustrator.
Okay.
Which is different.
All right.
In one of my biographies, I say I represent fine artists and not so fine artists.
That's, yeah.
Mike writes in from Saratoga, if I come up with the AI prompting, is any artwork or written material created by AI from those prompts copyrightable?
Not yet.
Okay, explain.
The copyright law says that that the work has to be made by a human, and I mean that was reinforced a couple of years ago when that monkey grabbed the camera and took a bunch of selfies, and that turned
which were great
of the monkey smiling into the camera.
I haven't seen this.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it was a meme. I mean, it went everywhere.
I don't see memes. I don't do that.
And the photographer tried to claim the copyright, and they said no. I mean the monkey gets the copyright, except monkeys can't get copyrights. But you don't get it. But AI prompts. I mean, the Copyright Office ruled last year that AI art was not going to be copyrightable at all. And I've seen cases where they're talking about, the guy comes in and said, "I did 600 prompts to get here," on a visual art
right.
or something. And how is that different than holding a brush? You're really directing. You've really got something in mind, and you're directing. And who knows where it's going to go? I mean, as we talked before, all these fair use things are in the courts. They're all like a lot of them are multi-billion-dollar cases. You know, but they have to get to the district court level, which might take a year or two. Then it goes to the appellate court. At some point, the Supreme Court's going to decide a whole bunch of stuff. But, you know, all the balls are in the air until that happens. And, you know, nobody's really going to know.
But that brings up an interesting thing, because I can see a distinct parallel between back in the day when I was doing illustration. A lot of the contracts I was handed were work made for hire contracts. And the argument was that I was merely being the wrist for the art director.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different from giving prompts through AI?
Good question.
Right. You know, or writing a computer program.
Right.
There's a good argument to be made that maybe the prompts will be copyrightable. But if they are, then somebody can't use those prompts and stick them into an AI generator to get the same painting. So maybe,
but they probably wouldn't get the same painting. But
that's true.
That was the argument that the Graphic Artists Guild used about why work made for hire was bogus. They gave prompts that basically described Grant Wood's American Gothic,
mm-hmm,
to 10, maybe 12 illustrators,
mm-hmm,
and had them each come up with their illustration based on those prompts.
Yeah.
They were wildly different.
I'd love to see that. Were any of them good?
Oh, yeah. Steve Brodner did a fabulous one. A lot of the artists came up with very interesting pieces.
You know, when I think about things like AI, and by the way, if you have a copyright question, the number is 800-348-2551. Paul Rapp is here. Polly Law is here to answer your questions. VoxPop@WAMC.org if you want to email. When I think about AI and the things that it can create, I often think about loops and synth loops,
mm-hmm,
for musicians who will use these loops that are, you basically buy them,
right,
and then you use them, but it's not, you can mix and match and do all you want, but you didn't make that loop,
right, and you're just programming them, and is that different than prompts in AI? That's a good question, and that's something that that's something that we're going to have to, you know, wait for the Supreme Court to deal with. It's a very good question, and these questions are coming up like every day as people are getting more and more used to AI and understanding what it is and using it. You know, a year ago I was afraid of it and wanted nothing to do with it. Now I use it every day.
For what? You've seen these things, and we saw this in the news again. Lawyers use this stuff and they come up with absolutely incorrect information.
Oh, they get slop. Yeah.
I mean,
I've asked it to write briefs, but you go through and you check every case, because they will cite a case.
Then why don't you just write it yourself?
That doesn't exist.
Time?
Oh, it saves a lot of time. Yeah. You know, you're.
It's easier to edit than to create.
And it gets better and better. I mean, I had a contract yesterday, you know, independent contractor for a filmmaker, and you know, I knew I had at least 10 of them in my word processor, but rather than go through and look at the ones that I'd written and pick out the best one, which could take an hour or two, I just tell ChatGPT to write one. I mean, I know what these contracts are supposed to look like,
right,
and what's supposed to be in them,
right,
and what the verbiage should look like. And they would, you know, send it out, and I'm going, well, that's a little wordy. Can you make it simpler? And then, boom, it comes back.
Ah.
And then I look it over. I see stuff they've missed. I mean, I use it to short circuit just a Google search, you know,
okay,
which a lot of people are complaining about. Wikipedia is talking about their traffic is way, way down.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And while they're a main source for an AI query, they're not getting hits.
They're not getting, yeah, the
human
eyeballs.
Hits, you know. And, you know, for a lot of people, that can be a problem.
You know, I don't have the details in front of me, but I know one of the major music labels, I don't know what you call them, record labels still, mm-hmm, I guess, they're doing something with AI generation.
I think they're licensing their repertoire to teach AI, and they're probably getting, I mean, while all these questions are up in the air, the AI guys, you know, are marching forward with lightning speed, and so they will pay for licenses, even though maybe in 5 years it'll be determined they don't need them. But they're using, you know, the record companies are making money allowing their music to be trained. Now, do you think any of that money is going to make it to a musician?
No. That's
no.
What I'm saying, that if I'm a composer, if I'm the Beatles or even, God forbid, the Raspberries, and somebody made a song that comes up sounding very similar,
mm-hmm.
you have no recourse.
No, my friend, I have a friend in Kingston that plays with a very famous alternative rock band, and they've been around for 30, 40 years. And somebody asked the AI generator to make an album that sounds like this band. And he's going, it's fantastic.
Ah.
It sounds like it. The cryptic lyrics, the funny, it was one of our, I mean, it could have been one of our albums easily. And that's kind of remarkable. And this week, I think the first AI generated song has hit the top 40.
What is this?
I don't remember.
All right.
And I sure wasn't going to go listen to it.
Fair enough. James writes in, I'm writing a James Bond screenplay just for fun, but I'm pleased with how it's going. Should I or can I copyright it? Is that fan fiction?
Yeah, I mean, you can copyright it. You might not be able to publish it or do much with it outside of the James Bond universe. I don't know how they... I don't know how the James Bond people, which is now what, Amazon, didn't they buy all the rights from the Broccoli family?
Couldn't he send it in as a treatment?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you could pitch the James Bond people, but I don't know how they would handle fan fiction. You know, some of these big franchises, a lot of video games just encourage fan fiction because it's good for business.
Well, a lot of the big shots too have just thrown in the towel.
Yeah,
it's like you know. Standing in front of a tsunami and say, stop, stop.
But he wouldn't be able to make a James Bond movie,
right?
You know, outside. But, you know, you just change the name to, you know.
So when that guy...
Frank Bond.
So when that guy picked up the James Bond franchise writing books, I forget the guy's name, back in the 80s.
Ian Fleming.
The
revamped one.
Right. That was all licensed, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to the phones.
He was hired by the publisher to do it, I'm sure.
Yeah, they were okay. 800-348-2551. Joseph in Clifton Park, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about the DMCA, especially on larger platforms like YouTube. You know, for a long time, it's been an ongoing problem where sometimes copyright claims that are incorrect or straight up fraudulent end up having some serious impacts on smaller creators. And, you know, on YouTube, this process can sometimes be automatic or very one-sided. And, you know, it can take a long time to get it resolved. Is there any recourse that, you know, the little guy has for either lost revenue or, you know, removed accounts if they are... you know, the victim of fraudulent or malicious DMCA requests?
I think there is, but it would probably be, you know, a real ordeal, you know, to you're talking about going to court and suing. You know, in a related thing, my partner's Facebook page was wiped out because they said she was, violating community standards when she clearly wasn't. In fact, there was an explicit community standard that allowed her photographs to go on, but she couldn't get anybody to talk to. And then when she found somebody to talk to, that you know, it was someone in Singapore or, you know, somewhere, and you could barely understand them, and they would promise things and say they were going to escalate it, and that never happened. And a number of people said, you know, complain to the attorney general. And it occurred to me, and they said people do it all the time. And it occurred to me the attorney generals of the various states are now doing customer service for Facebook and undoubtedly for Google and YouTube and all the rest. But they do have they do have offices and lawyers that are there to handle these kind of complaints.
Interesting.
And as it was funny, I actually, you know, it was a month and her site was still down, and it was a not-for-profit site. And she was getting nowhere and had put out her feelers everywhere. And I had written a federal complaint. Actually, ChatGPT helped me. To write a federal complaint against Facebook for wrongfully taking this down with, you know, all these causes of action and damages to be determined and all that. And I was going to file it because, you know, in federal court in Albany, just because I think them getting it would wake them up and then they would go. It would cost us, you know, my time plus $400 for the filing fee. But it seemed to me that that would resolve it. And an hour before I was going to file, her profile went back up.
Oh.
And people are going, they knew what you were doing.
How did they know?
How did they know?
Yeah. Oh, you think? That's interesting. Joseph, you want to follow up before we take a break?
Yeah. So that's great information and a really interesting story. And I've heard that's happening to a lot of people. But when there's a third party involved, you know, so let's say Sony Music Group says that my YouTube video used their content when it just absolutely didn't, but, you know, it's incorrect. And YouTube takes action against me. You know, I can't talk to YouTube. You know, that's a lost cause. But, you know, can I do anything to Sony for this? You know, obviously they're a big corporation of lots of lawyers, but, like, is there anything?
I wonder if you could get to talk to
Sony. Automatic process they have?
Because it seems to me that there's been no human intervention other than you. That Sony are using bots on YouTube to detect stuff, and the stuff gets flagged and comes down automatically.
Huh.
And there's been no human referee here yet, and it sounds like you've got a good case. So I think I would just rattle the cages at both Sony and YouTube until you can talk to somebody. And I know you can do a counter.
But there is liability.
You know, if you get a DMCA strike, you can protest it. And provide evidence for, you know, and so do all that. Read the terms of service. When you get the DMC strike, they'll probably describe to you how you can oppose it. And I would follow that to the letter and just hope for the best.
Joseph, thanks a lot. We're overdue for a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Copyright Forum. Paul Rapp, Polly Law, and we'll check the email bag in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Copyright Forum in progress here. Paul Rapp, Polly Law, join us. And let's grab a couple emails here from voxpop@wamc.org. This one's from Kelly. I'm an artist creating visual pieces that are responses to musical pieces. Think Kandinsky. I would like to post my process on Instagram, but it would require me to play the music while I work. Not the original recording directly to download it on my computer. Instead, it's on a radio in the background in the room that I'm working in. Is that legal?
Ooh. I mean, it's going to depend, I think, where you post it. And again, we're talking about bots. And so, and you're talking about classical music, much of which is going to be in the public domain. Maybe not the performance. But, you know, I mean, you can try it and see what happens. Be ready for some kind of strike. But, you know, I understand it. It's part. It would be fair use because it's part of your process. You're showing your process. The music isn't there just to be enjoyed. It's there to be a vehicle for your painting. Well, so it sounds like fair use to me.
It's like in a lot of books nowadays, the author will say, this is the music I listened to while I was writing.
Mm-hmm.
And they list a bunch of.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. And that's fine. But to actually play the music and
yes.
show it while she's painting.
Right.
I would try it. But don't be surprised if it gets disappeared overnight.
She won't get sued. It'll just get taken down.
Yeah. They never sue at the beginning. If you keep doing it, they might sue if you're a repeat offender, but generally, if you take the stuff down.
Could she possibly check? Because a lot of people put music against their videos, and it may be that the music that she's using for inspiration is available.
It could be available. You could find something that doesn't have a copyright on it. There's a lot of classical classical recordings from the 60s and 70s from Eastern Europe that are in the public domain. So you can use those. And also, you know, the classical music labels, you know, because we're talking about, you may have a work by Beethoven, which has been in the public domain for hundreds of years. But if it's a recording that was made 10 years ago by the New York Philharmonic, the New York Philharmonic's going to own that recording. But I'm not sure that a lot of classical music's like go and do bots to take down, you know, because they're just happy
it's
that somebody's
It's all promotion for them.
They're just happy somebody's listening, you know, these days. So, yeah, I would go ahead and do it.
All right, number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Timothy writes, what about artists that have their work made for them by other people? For instance, large-scale sculptures. The artist may have had the idea, but to the people who actually did the work, do they get any credit?
That makes the worker bees. They are probably under a work made for hire contract.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jeff Koons, you know, never was hands on. Andy Warhol was not terribly, you know, at least the last half of his career was not hands on. He had people working for him. So and they'll have work for hire contracts, which will say that the principal, the person that's paying the money, is going to be the copyright owner at the first insistence. And there was who's that guy, Dale Jehuli, the glass guy. You know, his main assistant, who did almost all the work, left and started his own studio, making similar similar works. And Jehuli sued, you know, said, you're copying my style. And I
trade dress, which is a whole quagmire.
Sorry, what is that? Trade dress?
Might be trade dress, but you know, style is not something you can protect under any theory. For obvious reasons. I mean, this is how art grows and is developed. So, you know, what was the original question?
I don't know.
The people that create works under
Generally, no.
So any of those people working for the Thomas Kincaid concern, they're being paid by the Kincaids. So they're being paid by the corporation.
And, right. Probably by the piece.
Interesting. All right, let's go to Warwick. Anna, you're on. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I am calling because I'm a working musician, and my duo band we're called Root One, and we've been performing around the area, and we keep hearing so much about AI music. I was listening to you guys talk just a few minutes ago about how AI composed music and AI generated music is hitting the top charts. And I just had a question to you, you know, just out of opinion, if you think that AI music could ultimately take over the spotlight from real life humans.
I hope not.
I think it'll take it away on I don't want to call it the fringes, but in some, you know, movie scoring, for example.
Commercials.
Yeah. Commercial.
Yeah, jingle music. Writers are looking at their resumes right now.
Yeah, and I think in terms of popular music, a lot of this stuff is personality driven as much as it's music driven, although there's AI personalities coming out now.
Really?
We have, you know.
Which is something that I think is absolutely crazy because my partner and I were out hitting our boots are on the ground. We're getting gigs as much as we can, and we just recorded music, and we're trying to, you know, spread it out for people to listen to. And then we see these, you know, these AI songs that are getting millions and millions of views. And to my opinion, I think some of it's kind of trash. But, and so it's just crazy to me to see that, you know, AI is coming up with music that then can't be performed in a live show. I mean, unless then holograms and all of these things start to come out.
Oh God! Oh boy!
Yeah, or they hire actors to come out and be
lip
sync, you know, be a tribute band.
You mean like Milli Vanilli?
Oh
yeah.
God!
Be a tribute band to a band that doesn't really exist.
Oh, and I feel like that takes the potency away from the art that can really be created by people like myself.
Well, in terms of live,
my partner,
I think it's less of a threat than, you know, when DJs, you know, all of a sudden became current, you know, and bars were hiring DJs
and live bands didn't get gigs.
Weddings would have DJs instead of live bands. I mean, that was kind of catastrophic.
Oh, that's a good point.
And I don't see this being that bad as yet, but it certainly could get there. Like I said, the ramifications of AI become more clear every day.
I will say that a lot of competition, art competitions, you submit work to be in a show, blah, blah, blah. They will explicitly state now no AI generated images. Mm-hmm.
Right. All right, Anna,
how can people even tell at this point? I refuse to use AI personally.
It's pretty easy to tell.
I'm 29 years old.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of friends that use it left and right, and I'm just, nope, I'm staying away from that. Because I just feel like it really kind of takes away the creativity and what our minds can actually create on their own.
I agree, Anna. I'm with you. You know what? Keep humans in art. That would be good. Thank you for the call, and we'll look out for Route 1. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum with Polly Law and Paul Rapp. And let's go to Lowell in Saugerties. Lowell, you're on.
Hey, Annie.
Oh, hello. Hi, Polly. You know me.
it's Friends Week on the Copyright Forum.
Yeah, Friends Week here. All right. My brother, who died recently, wrote his memoirs. He lived in the Middle East, overseas, for many years, and had great adventures, and he wrote a wonderful, wonderful memoir. He didn't want to try to publish it because he didn't want to edit it. So I published it for him as a blog. So anybody could go online and read it as a blog, but that's very difficult. You know, there's no page numbers. It's not easy to read. And I put photographs in. I did some work on it, but it was his writing. He didn't want to publish it. And now he's gone, and my daughter has taken the blog and put it into a hard, a real book form on Lulu. Mm-hmm. So there is two volumes of this really wonderful book. If somebody wanted to publish it, if we found a publisher who wanted to go with it, who would own it? My brother's gone. He didn't leave it to his children. It's not really mine. It's not really my daughter's. Who owns it? Who has the copyright? Who gets the royalty?
Sounds like a lawyer question.
Did he have a will?
Will, but it didn't mention that at all.
It probably had a residuary clause where it said everything that's not otherwise accounted for explicitly will go to so and so, and it's probably his kids. But I would check his will and talk to a trust in the estates because a copyright, even a common law copyright, passes like all other kinds of property. And so even though he didn't, it's usually like the last paragraph in a will. Where
heirs
they say,
and assigns.
Yeah, everything that we haven't mentioned here is going to go to blah, blah. Uh-huh.
Right. All right.
And it may go to his kids equally.
They had nothing to do with it. My daughter and I worked on it. I didn't know if that gave us any right to it.
Mm-mm.
Nope.
Okay.
You can count on family feelings to negotiate this.
I could tell you stories.
Yeah. You could. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Thank you very much for the call. By the way, Polly, you're one of the nicest people. You hand Paul a lozenge during the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's very kind.
Aw, shucks.
Ricola. Do you have one of those horns? You know,
Ricola.
Yeah,
no.
That'd be great. Okay, we can't do
An
that.
An Alpenhorn.
All right, let's go to the email bag. This is from Dan. I've been making a website for my photography work, over 200 images on a website. I'm trying to figure out if a website is a safe place for the images. I've looked into removing right mouse click and screen share options, but are there any other ideas as to how to keep photos safe short of copywriting each photo with the Library of Congress 45 times 200, says Dan.
Photographers, though, have a bonus.
Yeah, you can do it by year, and I think it's an unlimited number of photographs.
Really?
For one, like 65. Check out copyright.gov, the registration of photographs, because you can, I think, very easily and fairly cheaply register them all. That's not going to stop anybody from pointing and clicking on your website and taking the stuff anyways. That just means you have more ammunition to chase them around with. I think what you want to do is make sure you don't put high res.
Okay, Dan said that. Should I put lower res? Polly, do you do that?
72.
Yeah, 72
is DPI. Is not a printable resolution. And I also embed my copyright notice in the art.
So what do they call that, a watermark?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can put a watermark on. I you know, you're kind of defacing your art, but if you do a small watermark, that's fine. I mean, there's programs that remove watermarks.
Yeah,
you can do that easily, but at least it's there and it's clear. And if you find somebody using it, they can't say it wasn't willful. They can't say I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, and have a copyright notice on the website as well.
Okay. Glenn writes in, there's a famous movie from the 1950s that was never remade. It was based on a story that was published in a magazine in 1936 that is now in public domain. Would readapting the original story into a new screenplay with different characters and names be an infringement on the 1950s movie?
No.
1936 is public domain?
They said it's in the public domain, so it maybe wasn't, you know, renewed or something. Yeah, you can do that. The studio that did the 1950s film might have other ideas, but, you know, if you just make sure and double check and triple check that you're not taking scenes, you're not taking characters' names.
But if they're in the book and you change...
If they're in the book, you can take them, yeah.
But if the movie, you know, if the screenplay writers change things, you know, like the movie version of War of the Worlds with Gene Barry is very different from the book. And, you know, H.G. Wells's book, and you could follow H.G. Wells's book and use that title, and you'd be in the free and clear.
Yeah, the answer is yes, but, you know, be careful and get second and third opinions of that, you know.
People who are knowledgeable of both sources, because possible sources.
Yeah, you can take whatever you want from the original article and do whatever you want with it, but you can't take much of anything that's original to the movie.
You know, it's funny. If this movie was from the 50s and it was very famous and it's never been remade, why? They've remade everything 12 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so how famous could it be?
Well, maybe famous, but not worth remaking.
That's an interesting one. All right, Polly Law, how do people find out about your doings and check out your work and stuff?
The best way is on Instagram. I still do not have a functioning website. That's one of my tasks. Well, because I can't decide. I'm looking at options for WYSIWYG programs to build a site, and I haven't found one that really makes me happy.
Have AI do it. Yeah.
Anyway, you can follow me on Instagram at art. Words T. That's T-E-A-T.
Art Words T.
Yes.
And Paul Rapp, if people want to find out about your AI now driven services.
Yeah. My email is paul@paulrapp.com.
Okay, fair enough. You're all in on the AI, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, it saves me a lot of time and the quality is I mean, you don't take anything at face value. Anything, you know.
Right.
But you know, it does find sources. It does, you know, and you do follow up questions. It's great.
Well, we'll talk more about this over and over again on Copyright Forums ahead. Support comes from the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls, featuring A Feast of Fruit and Flowers, a new exhibition celebrating women artists from the 17th century who helped shape the still life genre, on view October 25th through March 8th, HydeCollection.org. And Fatigan's Nursery, Latham, New York, featuring 3 year-round greenhouses with a variety of tropical houseplants, orchids, succulents, plus botanically inspired home decor and gifts, Fatigan's.com. Thanks again to Paul Rapp and Polly Law, both not at 100%, but they came in, and thank you. And Bill Westwood, hope you're feeling better, man. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Andrea Leung screened the calls today. Thank you, Andrea. I'm Ray Graff. Hey, tomorrow we'll talk taxes with Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty. We'll find you a loophole or two and whatnot. We'll see you at 2 p.m.